We would like to send out a special thanks to Avast for supporting The Trail Went Cold. With Avast One, you can confidently take control of your online world by helping you stay safe from viruses, phishing attacks, ransomware, hacking attempts, and other cybercrimes. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. Enjoy the show. April 18th, 1943. Hagley, England. A group of teenage boys discover an unidentified female skeleton inside a hollow witch elm tree near Witchberry Hill. It is determined that the victim was killed at least 18 months before she was found, and her likely cause of death was suffocation. Over the next several decades, mysterious graffiti messages pop up in numerous locations, which are variations of the phrase, "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" While there are several theories surrounding the victim's death, including possible connections to espionage and witchcraft, she cannot be identified, and the circumstances of how she was killed remain unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we're going to be traveling to the United Kingdom to explore a bizarre mystery, which is most commonly known as, Who Put Bella in the Witch Elm? Ever since the inception of this podcast, it's been a tradition for us to count down to Halloween by spending the month of October covering mysteries which either took place on Halloween or have some sort of spooky or paranormal slant to them. This year, I'll be following the same approach I used last Halloween by putting together episodes about unsolved cold cases which are alleged to have ties to supernatural elements, though this is often the result of misinformation and sensationalistic details. And while today's featured case almost sounds like some sort of urban legend, it's definitely real, and the whole thing is considered to be one of England's most unusual mysteries. Nearly 80 years ago, a skeleton belonging to an unidentified woman was found inside a hollow witch elm tree in the English countryside, but even though it seemed likely that she was the victim of a homicide and was killed at least a year and a half before her discovery, no one could figure out who she was or how her remains wound up in that location. As the years went on, a number of cryptic graffiti messages would pop up around the area, which were all variations of the phrase, "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" though it could not be conclusively determined if Bella was the victim's name. You might recall that last October, I briefly made mention of this story in an episode I released about the unsolved murder of Charles Walton, an elderly farm laborer who was murdered under bizarre circumstances in another English village a few years later. In both of these cases, one of the most prevalent theories is that the victim's death was connected to witchcraft and the occult, and as a result, a lot of misinformation is spread, and it can be difficult to separate fact from fiction. I should mention up front that even though you'll frequently hear the term witch elm, the correct spelling of witch in this context is actually W-Y-C-H, not W-I-T-C-H. This particular story is also complicated by the fact that it took place during World War II, so there's been a lot of speculation that the woman known only as Bella might have been a spy. One of the primary sources I'm using for this episode is a two-volume series of books titled Who Put Bella in the Witch Elm, published by author Alex Merrill, who was able to acquire some of the original case documents. These books have helped clear up some of the misconceptions surrounding this case, so on this episode, I will try to stay as fact-based about this story as possible. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start exploring the mystery of who put Bella in the Witch Elm. Our story begins in 1943 in Hagley, England, a village and civil parish located in the county of Worcestershire on the boundary of the West Midlands. On Sunday, April the 18th, the area was visited by four local teenage boys, 15-year-old Robert Hart, 17-year-old Thomas Willits, 15-year-old Bob Farmer, and 14-year-old Fred Payne, who all lived in residential areas just outside the town of Stourbridge. The boys were reportedly poaching for rabbits in Hagley Wood, which was part of the 1,200-acre Hagley estate, and while heading home during the early evening hours, they came across a large witch elm tree located near Witchberry Hill. Since the boys thought this might be a good spot to search for eggs and birds' nests, Robert Hart decided to climb the tree, but soon noticed what appeared to be a skull inside the hollow cavity. The skull had broken into two parts, which separated the head and the lower jaw, and since Robert initially believed it was an animal skull, Bob Farmer used a stick in order to extract it from the tree. However, since the skull had what appeared to be tufts of light brown hair attached to a small patch of rotting flesh on the forehead, it became apparent that it was human. Since the boys had technically been trespassing on someone else's land, they decided it would not be a good idea to tell anyone about what they found and place the skull back into the tree. They subsequently headed home, but since Thomas Willits felt uneasy about the whole situation, it wasn't long before he told his parents about what he found, and they reported the discovery to the authorities. The following morning, the police arrived at the scene and found the skull. It turned out that the witch elm was also concealing a nearly complete human skeleton inside the tree's hollow cavity, along with some fragments of clothing, including a khaki and mustard-colored cloth skirt, a dark peach or fawn underskirt or slip, navy blue knickers, a corset, and a pale khaki or mustard-colored knitted cardigan with dark blue stripes and a knitted belt. A size 5.5 blue crepe-soled shoe was also inside the tree, and the matching shoe was found a short distance away. A search of the area would turn up some additional skeletal remains scattered near the tree, including a left pelvic bone, a right fibula, and a right femur. Some of the victim's bones could not be found, including most of her hyoid bone, patella, right tibia, and various small bones from her hands and feet. We'll talk more about this later, but even though many accounts state that either the victim's right hand or some finger bones were found buried about 10 meters away from the tree, there's no mention of this in the original documentation. The remains would be sent to Professor James Webster, head of the Home Office Forensic Science Laboratory in the West Midlands. After performing a forensic examination, he concluded that the victim was around 5 feet tall and likely between 25 and 40 years old, with her estimated age being 35. He believed that she died at least 18 months before she was found, placing her approximate time of death sometime in October of 1941 or before. Webster also thought she may have gone through at least one pregnancy at some point, though this was never conclusively determined. Given the measurements of the tree's hollow cavity, Webster believed that the victim had to be placed inside there while she was still alive, or a short time after she died, as he did not think her body would have fit after rigor mortis took place. A section of taffeta, a fabric often used in dresses and corsets, was found inside the victim's mouth, so Webster concluded that she was the victim of a homicide and her likely cause of death was suffocation. However, it must be mentioned that when he used the stick to pry the skull out of the tree, Bob Farmer believed he may have knocked a fragment of clothing into the mouth, so it's possible that the taffeta wound up there accidentally and was not used to suffocate the victim. The woman's left lateral incisor and second right molar on her top jaw were missing and could not be recovered, but her two front teeth were quite distinctive because of how crooked they were. Investigators contacted dentists from all over the country, but could not turn up any matching dental records for women who fit the victim's description. They were able to trace the blue, crepe-soled shoes back to their original manufacturer and the stores where they were sold, but the shoes could not be linked to anyone. All attempts to cross-reference the victim with missing persons reports from the area failed to turn up any women who might have been her, so she continued to remain unidentified. However, on March 28, 1944, The case would take an interesting turn when some odd cryptic graffiti suddenly appeared on a wall on Upper Dean Street in the city of Birmingham, located around 15 miles from where the skeleton was found. It read, quote, "Who put Bella down the witch elm? Hagley Wood," end quote. Another graffiti message was found on an adjoining wall on Pershore Street, which read, quote, "Hagley Wood, Bella." 2 days later, it was reported that more graffiti had been seen on a cottage wall in Haydon Hill, a residential area located near the town of Haleshowen, about 5 miles away from Hagley. This one read, quote, "Who put Lou Beller in the witch elm?" One witness claimed that he had seen that particular graffiti as early as December of 1943, even though it was not officially reported to the police for over 3 months. Regardless, all three messages have been written in block letters with white chalk and look similar enough that the authorities believe they were all done by the same person. Anyway, even though I have no idea if Bella was actually the victim's real name, that's how I'll be referring to her throughout the rest of this episode. Over the next several months, more cryptic messages written in chalk started appearing in random locations throughout the West Midlands. On August the 1st, a message was found underneath an archway in the city of Wolverhampton, located just over 13 miles from Hagley. It read, quote, "Hagley Wood Lubella, address opposite the Rose and Crown, Hasbury." 2 days later, more graffiti popped up in Wolverhampton on a wooden fence at Shelton Lane, and it read, quote, "Address was opposite Rose and Crown, Hasbury, Hagley Wood, Lubella." Later that same day, additional graffiti was discovered written on a wall underneath a railway arch, and this read, quote, "Hagley Wood, Lubella was no pros." The word pros was presumably short for prostitute, and while Hasbury happened to be a suburb in Haleshowen, which had a pub called the Rose and Crown, the message about Lubella's address being across from there didn't seem to have any significance. In October of that year, more graffiti would appear in the market town of Oldbury, which read, quote, "Hagley Wood Lubella address was 404 Lower Hasbury, Haleshowen." But once again, this lead went nowhere, because even though 404 Lower Hasbury was a real address in Haleshowen, it turned out that an elderly couple had lived there for the past 56 years. It was unclear if all these messages had been written by the same person, or if they were a series of copycat messages inspired by the news coverage the original graffiti received. Investigators explored another interesting lead in November of that year after they were contacted by a sex worker from Birmingham. She claimed that she had once known another sex worker named Bella, whom she said was Dutch and often worked in the Hagley area. Bella had inexplicably gone missing 3 years earlier, which would have been the approximate time period that the victim from the witch elm was believed to be killed, but this lead ultimately never went anywhere. All attempts to uncover Bella's true identity were unsuccessful, and the investigation remained at a standstill for the next several years, but in November of 1953, columnist Wilfred Byford Jones published a pair of news articles about the case in the Wolverhampton Express and Star under his pseudonym, Quester Seeker. I'll go into more detail about this angle later on in this episode, but the articles explored the possibility that Bella's murder was linked to witchcraft and had a connection to the unsolved murder of 74-year-old Charles Walton, which took place on February the 14th, 1945, in the village of Lower Quinton, just over 40 miles away from where Bella had been found. Well, right after the publication of the two articles, the Express and Star's head office received a letter intended for Wilfred Byford Jones, which was postmarked from the village of Claverley, located about 13 miles northwest of Hagley Wood. It read, quote, "Finish your articles on the witch elm by all means. They are interesting to your readers, but you will never solve the mystery. The affair is closed and involves no witches, black magic, or moonlight rites. The only clues I can give you are that the person responsible for the crime died insane in 1942, and the victim was Dutch and arrived illegally in England about 1941. I have no wish to recall any more. I am no hoaxer. What happened to our mutual friend, did he return too? Yours sincerely, Anna." End quote. The Express and Star decided to publish this letter a few days later in hopes that the mysterious Anna might come forward. Just over 1 week later, Anna sent in another letter and agreed to a meeting with the Worcestershire Criminal Investigation Division. It turned out that Anna's real name was Una Hainsworth, and she shared a story about her former husband, Jack Mossop, who'd allegedly confessed about his involvement in Bella's death. Now, like many other aspects of this case, you're going to find conflicting details from different sources about Una's story, but these are the two most commonly shared versions. According to Una, her husband had become friends with a Dutchman whom she only knew as Van Ralt, and Jack would sometimes come home with large sums of money without explaining where he got it. Since World War II was still raging on, Una suspected that Jack had become involved in a spy ring and was selling off information about local munitions factories. Una said that sometime in March or April of 1941, Jack came home agitated, claiming that he had been out with Van Ralt and another friend who had performed as a trapeze artist at the new Hippodrome in Coventry. They were in the company of a Dutch woman who had entered England illegally and may have been working as an emissary for the spy ring. On this particular night, Jack had been driving Van Ralt, the trapeze artist, and the woman through Halesowen with the three of them in the back seat when something went horribly wrong and the two men told Jack that the woman was dead. They then instructed him to drive into Hagley Wood, and Jack proceeded to help the two men hide the woman's body inside the Witch Elm. Jack believed that the woman may have been murdered because she knew too much about the spy ring. The second version of this story is that Jack and Van Ralt had been drinking at a pub called the Littleton Arms with a woman whom he referred to as the quote-unquote Dutch piece. As the night went on, the woman became increasingly intoxicated and passed out while the two men were driving away from the pub. Van Ralt then came up with the idea of driving to Hagley Wood and placing the woman's unconscious body inside the hollow witch elm in order to teach her a lesson and allow her to realize the error of her ways. They never had any intention of harming her, but the woman wound up dying inside the tree, and her body would not be discovered for nearly 2 years. Whatever version is correct, Una said that her marriage to Jack fell apart, and she left him and moved away to the town of Henley in Arden in December of 1941. The last time Una saw Jack, he apparently told her that he believed that he was losing his mind and was plagued with recurring visions of a woman leering at him from inside a tree. Shortly thereafter, Jack suffered a complete mental breakdown and was confined to a mental health facility in Stafford. In August of 1942, Jack passed away inside the facility at the age of 29, and his causes of death were listed as, quote-unquote, cerebral softening, myocardial degeneration, chronic nephritis, and acute confusional insanity. Well, there were apparently certain aspects of Una's story which did check out, but investigators were unable to identify the mysterious Dutchman, known only as Van Ralt, or the trapeze artist who had performed at the new Hippodrome. In the end, no corroborating evidence could be found to conclusively prove that Una's account was true. In 1968, author Donald McCormick published a book about this story, titled Murder by Witchcraft, which not only explored the possibility that Bella's death was linked to witchcraft and the occult, but also presented a theory that Bella may have been a secret agent named Clarabella Dronkers. According to McCormick, he had obtained information from a series of documents known as the Abwehr Diaries, as the Abwehr were a German military intelligence service controlled by the Nazis during World War II. McCormick claimed that in March or April of 1941, the Abwehr inserted 5 secret agents into England, one of whom was a woman codenamed Clara, that supposedly parachuted into the West Midlands under the cover of an air raid, but failed to make any further contact with her superiors. Even though Clara passed herself off as being Dutch, this may have been nothing more than an elaborate cover, and McCormick claimed that he managed to track down a former Nazi living in Paraguay under an assumed name, who corroborated a lot of the details about Clara's backstory. Well, Donald McCormick has always been known for having serious credibility issues and making unsubstantiated claims, not just in Murder by Witchcraft, but in many of the books he wrote throughout his career. I'll talk more about this later on, but right now, I want to share another prominent theory about Bella being a wartime spy, which has officially been debunked. At one point, there was speculation that Bella may have been a German cabaret singer and actress named Clara Bowerly. In January of 1941, a German spy named Joseph Jacobs, who worked for the Abwehr, was captured after he attempted to parachute into England and broke his ankle during the landing. At the time, Jacobs was carrying a photograph of Clara Bowerly, which had this message written on the back, quote, "My dear, I love you forever, your Clara, Landau, July 1940, end quote. While he was being interrogated, Jacobs claimed that Bowerly was his lover and that she was also a spy, as she had spent years performing in music halls in the West Midlands and was able to speak English with a convincing British accent. Jacobs also said that if he had been able to make radio contact with his superiors, Bowerly was probably going to join him on his mission. On August the 15th, Jacobs was put to death by a firing squad on the grounds of the Tower of London, making him the last person to ever be executed at that location. For years, Clara Bowerly's whereabouts after the spring of 1941 could not be substantiated, and since she was in her mid-30s at that time, it was theorized that she may have traveled to England at some point before she was killed and was the mysterious Bella. However, Joseph Jacobs' granddaughter, Giselle Jacobs, would conduct extensive research into this issue, which she shared on her personal blog. In September of 2016, she announced that she had uncovered official records confirming that Clara Bowerly died in a Berlin hospital on December the 16th, 1942, which ruled out the possibility that she could have been Bella. On August the 27th, 1984, the cryptic graffiti would make its return in this case when the words, quote, "Who put Bella in the Witch Elm?" were scrawled on a car park wall behind the library in Hagley. In 1993, shortly after the Wolverhampton Express and Star published a 50th anniversary article about the discovery of Bella's body, the words, quote, "Who put Bella in the Witch Elm?" suddenly appeared on the Hagley obelisk, an 84-foot-high 18th-century stone monument located next to the summit of Witchberry Hill. But it's worth mentioning that in this particular graffiti, witch is actually spelled W-I-T-C-H as opposed to W-Y-C-H. Since there was fear that attempting to power wash the graffiti off the obelisk might cause the old structure to collapse, the message continues to remain there to this day and is the image most closely associated with this case. However, for unknown reasons, in November of 2020, somebody decided to cross out the word who and write the word hers over it. In July of 2005, the West Mercia Police published an official police closure report in which they recommended that the investigation be closed and all the original case documents be donated to the Worcestershire Records Office and archived for historic purposes. The main reason there is no longer an active investigation is because the current whereabouts of Bella's skeleton are unknown, as they somehow went missing after Professor James Webster bequeathed the remains to a friend at Birmingham University Medical School for some unofficial tests. In recent years, the Face Lab at Liverpool John Moores University has used old photographs of Bella's skull to create a forensic facial reconstruction of what she may have looked like. But unfortunately, without Bella's actual remains, DNA testing cannot be performed to determine her identity, so after nearly 80 years, the question of who put Bella in the Witch Elm continues to remain unanswered. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to our newest sponsor, Avast, who have been the global leader in cyber protection for more than 30 years. In fact, it was over 30 years ago when I first watched the infamous Dark Dante segment on Unsolved Mysteries, which opened my eyes about the importance of digital safety and privacy. Thankfully, we have Avast to protect us, as they prevent over 1.5 billion attacks every month, and are trusted by over 435 million people. No matter who you are, where you are, or how you connect, Avast will offer protection and allow you to enjoy the opportunities that come with being connected on your own terms. Avast also has a new all-in-one solution called Avast One, which helps you take control of your safety and privacy online through a range of features. It's accessible through a single, easy-to-use interface, and its free version still contains the award-winning free antivirus, free VPN, free firewall, and so much more. Their privacy features keep your identity and actions hidden, their security solutions stop malware, phishing, and virus attacks, and their performance products clean up and speed up your devices. Avast offers firewall and ransomware protection that keeps your personal information secure and prevents attacks which might involve stealing or compromising your data. In addition, Avast also has a premium version with even more advanced protection that allows you to protect multiple devices. Obviously, when you're researching a true crime podcast, you have to spend a lot of time online, putting yourself in a position where you might be vulnerable to a cyber attack. That's why I feel a lot more secure having a Vast One installed on my devices, which will save me the trouble of potentially crossing paths with my own Dark Dante. So once again, thanks to Avast for supporting the Trail When Cold. Confidently take control of your online world with Avast One. It helps you stay safe from viruses, phishing attacks, ransomware, hacking attempts, and other cybercrimes. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. That's avast.com. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So when I released my episode about the murder of Charles Walton right before Halloween last year, and briefly made mention of the Who Put Bella in the Witch Elm saga, I pretty much decided I would be covering that story right before Halloween this year. I'm not going to go into too many details about the Charles Walton case here, so if you'd like to learn more, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to episode number 247. But to recap, Charles was a 74-year-old farm laborer who was murdered on February the 14th, 1945, while working on a hedgerow located on the slopes of Neon Hill near the village of Lower Quinton. He was beaten with his walking stick, had his throat slashed with a billhook, and was stabbed with a pitchfork. But over the years, a lot of misinformation about this case has been spread to give off the impression that Charles's death was somehow related to witchcraft and the occult. In fact, some of the most commonly shared details about the case, such as a cross being carved into Charles's chest, are not mentioned in the original police reports and are most likely false. One of the primary sources I used for my episode last year was the 2014 book, The Case That Foiled Fabian, Murder and Witchcraft in Rural England, as the author, Simon Reed, was able to obtain the actual case files and clear up a lot of the misconceptions. So for this episode, it was very useful to read Alex Merrill's Who Put Bella in the Witch Elm book, which was released in 2018 and split up into two volumes titled The Crime Scene and A Crime Shrouded in Mystery. Since he was able to access the original case files, the books provide a better idea of which pieces of information are fact and which are fiction, though there are still issues with conflicting details from different sources and a number of unanswered questions. I can understand why links have often been made between this case and the murder of Charles Walton, since the crimes took place within a few years of each other near two villages in the English countryside and have a number of unusual details. The person who started pushing forward the witchcraft angle in the Walton case was Margaret Murray, an anthropologist and archaeologist at University College in London. In September of 1950, Murray was interviewed about Walton's murder in the Birmingham Gazette, and made some comments about the Bella in the Witch Elm case. It seems like the witchcraft angle and possible connections to the Walton murder were expanded upon when Wilfred Byford Jones wrote his series about the case in the Wolverhampton Express and Star in November of 1953, and Donald McCormick published his own sensationalistic book, Murder by Witchcraft, in 1968. Well, anyone who has extensively studied Charles Walton's murder has concluded that the most likely theory is that the killer was a local resident named Alfred Potter, who had employed Charles as a part-time laborer on his farm, and may have committed murder over a simple dispute about unpaid wages. While the truth behind Bella's death is certainly not that simple, I do think it's safe to say that she was not murdered in some sort of occult ritual. It's been reported that even prior to World War II, there were always rumors in the area about witches' Sabbaths being held in Hagley Wood. And yes, as problematic as it sounds today, you'll often hear the word gypsy in conjunction with these rumors. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time delving into this angle, but one theory which was supposedly pushed forward by Margaret Murray is that Bella was murdered as part of a ritual called the Hand of Glory. The legend goes that if you were to cut off the hand of a condemned man who was about to be hanged and preserved it, the hand could be turned into a candle which would render people motionless. For instance, if someone wanted to break into a house and commit a burglary, bringing the Hand of Glory along and lighting it would cast a sleeping spell, which ensured that the house's occupants remained asleep the entire time. In fact, one of my all-time favorite films, the 1973 version of The Wicker Man, features a scene in which the Hand of Glory is placed inside the main character's room while he's sleeping, in hopes it will render him motionless for a long period of time. The main reason this particular theory has picked up so much steam in this case is because Bella's right hand was supposedly severed from her body and found buried near the Witch Elm. Now, there are some sources which state that finger bones were buried nearby rather than an entire hand, but like I mentioned earlier, there's nothing about a hand or finger bones being buried in the original police documentation. All it says is that various small bones from Bella's hands were missing, so I think this is a situation where certain false details supporting the witchcraft theory have been spread so often by so many different sources over the years that they've been accepted as fact. Yes, some of the victims' bones were scattered around the area near the tree, but I think that was most likely the result of animal activity rather than some sort of occult ritual. However, even if you discount all the witchcraft theories surrounding Bella's death, this case is still surrounded by another sensationalistic theory about the victim possibly being a foreign spy who met her end on some sort of secret mission. Given that World War II was taking place, and spies were being inserted into other countries all the time, I can definitely understand why people would gravitate towards this theory. However, I must harken back to the episode I released just over a month ago about the death of a Jane Doe known only as Jennifer Fairgate, who checked into the Oslo Plaza Hotel in Norway under a false name in 1995 and was found shot to death inside a room a few days later. This is another case in which there are so many strange details surrounding the victim's death that speculation has run rampant that she was a spy. But I also made a point to mention in that episode that espionage seems to be the default theory for so many cases involving unidentified decedents, and the truth often turns out to be far less complicated. You might have heard of the John Doe known only as the Somerton Man, who was found on a beach in the Somerton Park suburb of Adelaide, South Australia, in December of 1948. Once again, there was a lot of speculation that the Somerton Man may have been a spy, but in recent months, he has tentatively been identified as Carl Charles Webb, an electrical engineer who once worked as an instrument maker, and does not appear to have any ties to espionage. So the point I'm making is that it would not surprise me in the least if the spy theory does not have any merit in this particular case either, and Bella's backstory is a lot more mundane. I mentioned earlier that one prominent theory which has been debunked is that Bella was German cabaret singer Clara Bowerly, as it was determined that Bowerly died in Berlin in December of 1942. I guess what makes this case a lot tougher to solve than most cases involving unidentified decedents is that the victim was nothing more than a skeleton when she was found. And even though it's been estimated that Bella was dead inside the tree for at least 18 months, it's possible that she was killed even earlier than that, and we have no idea if she was even a British citizen or traveled to England from another country. Obviously, the most frustrating thing about this case is that the whereabouts of Bella's skeleton are currently an unsolved mystery on their own. The recent developments involving the Somerton Man show that even decedents who died 7 or 8 decades ago can be identified by a DNA testing, but this doesn't help much if there are no remains to extract DNA from. Given the circumstances, I can understand why the authorities consider this case to be closed unless, by some miracle, Bella's remains can be recovered or new evidence surfaces which sheds additional light on her death. However, that doesn't mean we can't discuss this case here, as there are two big mysteries rolled into one. What was Bella's true identity, and how did she wind up dead inside the Witch Elm? Well, even though this mystery is nearly 80 years old, I can understand why it's still so well remembered, because I cannot think of too many other cases in which the skeleton of an unidentified decedent was found inside a hollow tree. I know scenarios have been pushed forward that Bella's death could be accidental or an elaborate suicide, but I find that highly unlikely, as she was probably murdered by an unknown third party who placed her there. Since it would have been very difficult, if not impossible, to fit her body inside the tree's hollow cavity once rigor mortis set in, this suggests that Bella was placed there shortly after she was killed, rather than her body being moved there from another location. This is why it's been theorized that Bella's killer was a local resident who was familiar with the area, as an outsider may not have even known this hollow witch elm existed and would be an effective place to conceal a body. The tree was also located on an estate which was technically private property, so dragging Bella's body there seems like it would have been an awful lot of trouble unless the perpetrator knew what they were doing. Indeed, if those four boys hadn't been inclined to trespass on the estate in April of 1943 and climb the witch elm to take eggs from a bird's nest, who knows how much more time would have passed before the victim's skeleton was discovered. Now, the most commonly accepted explanation for Bella's death is that she died of suffocation after someone forced a section of taffeta inside her mouth. But it's been reported by some sources that when Bob Farmer used a stick to pull the skull out of the tree, he may have accidentally knocked a fragment of Bella's clothing into her mouth, meaning that the taffeta was not always there. That does not seem implausible, but if she was not suffocated by the taffeta, what was Bella's exact cause of death? Well, a small piece of bone was found in the debris, which Professor James Webster believed was one of the cornua of a hyoid bone, but the rest of the hyoid bone was never found. So I wonder if this could mean that Bella's cause of death might have been the result of manual strangulation, but there was just no way to tell for certain without the hyoid. Another key detail which is often shared about this case by many sources is that Bella was wearing a gold wedding ring when she was found. If Bella was married, then you have to wonder why no one ever reported her missing and how she was never identified, unless, of course, her spouse was the killer. But then again, I just push forward the theory that whomever placed Bella's body inside the witch elm was likely a local resident who was familiar with the area. If any of the local residents were married, and their spouse turned up missing during this time period without explanation, wouldn't that have attracted more attention? However, if Bella hailed from another country and originally got married there, then it's possible that her spouse had no involvement in her death and never even heard about Bella turning up dead in England. But I think it's worth mentioning that at no point in any of Alex Merrill's two books about this case does he refer to Bella's ring as a wedding ring. According to the original police and autopsy reports, it was only referred to as a quote-unquote rolled goit enamel ring. So perhaps the detail about the wedding ring is misinformation, and Bella was never married to begin with. At a coroner's inquest following the discovery of Bella's remains, Professor Webster expressed his belief that she may have experienced at least one pregnancy, though he could not say with 100% certainty. But I find it interesting that Webster specifically said that she had one pregnancy rather than stating that she had given birth. So does this imply that Bella may have experienced a miscarriage at some point in her life, but never actually had a child? It's tough to say, but if Bella was not from England, she could have previously given birth to a child in another country who never found out what happened to their mother. Of course, if she did have a child, then this is yet another reason why it's so frustrating that Bella's skeleton went missing, since DNA profiling and genetic genealogy could possibly turn up any descendants she has who are still living. In the pre-DNA era, the best way to identify John and Jane Doe's was through dental records, and since Bella's crooked front teeth gave her a very distinctive set of molars, I think there was hope this would turn up a match somewhere. But if she hailed from another country, or never saw a dentist in England in her life, possibly because she was poverty-stricken, then there might not have been any existing records for her. It's a shame that a facial reconstruction and composite sketch was not generated for Bella until 2018, because she has a very distinctive face, and these images might have jogged some memories for people if such technology had existed back in the 1940s. So now we have to talk about what is likely the main reason this case continues to remain in the public consciousness after all these years, and that's the cryptic graffiti. The truly ironic thing is that even though everyone associates this crime with the phrase, "Who put Bella in the witch elm?", none of the graffiti that popped up during the 1940s actually contained that exact phrase, but rather variations on it. But since "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" was scrawled on the Hagley Obelisk in 1993 and is still visible to this day, that's the phrase everyone remembers. Of course, it's highly unlikely that the person who left that graffiti in 1993 had any inside knowledge about the crime, and most of these cryptic messages which popped up over the years were probably the work of copycats. But investigators were certain that the original messages, which appeared back in 1944, were all written by the same person, and they were anxious to know if this individual actually knew who Bella was or what happened to her. It's also odd how even though at least two of these messages use the name Bella, there were actually a larger number of them which used the name Lou Bella, and at least one of them featured the name Lou Beller, with an E and an R on the end, rather than an A. Well, during my research, I turned up a surprising piece of information in an article I found at newspapers.com, and I have not seen this reported anywhere else, not even in Alex Merrill's books. Believe it or not, according to the November 28, 1953 edition of the Birmingham Gazette, the Worcestershire police managed to trace the man who wrote the original graffiti, which popped up back in 1944. Here's an exact quote from Detective Superintendent Tom Williams, head of the County Criminal Investigation Division. Quote, "It was the work of a crank, who we are satisfied knew nothing and had nothing to do with the case. So it seems that Bella wasn't even Bella after all." End quote. Wow. So even though I've repeatedly talked about this case being fraught with misinformation and contradictory details from different sources, this is an original newspaper article featuring an actual quote from one of the lead investigators, so I have no reason to believe this isn't true. Unfortunately, there are no specific details about how the police managed to track down the original graffiti writer, but it's worth noting that this news was shared a short time after Wilfred Byford Jones published a series of articles about the case in the Wolverhampton Express and Star. As you recall, this led to the paper receiving a cryptic letter from the woman calling herself Anna, and she had not yet been identified at this point. I have a feeling that the letter prompted investigators to take a fresh look at the case, and led to them uncovering the identity of the man who wrote the graffiti. If he truly had no knowledge about who the woman in the Witch Elm was, or how she died, then I have no idea why he selected the name Bella, but for whatever reason, it seemed to stick. I do wish I could find other sources to corroborate the information I just shared with you, but it would be truly ironic if the "who put Bella in the Witch Elm" phrase was ruled out as having any significance to this case nearly 70 years ago, yet nobody knows that. This may be due to the fact that a number of copycats have left the same graffiti at various locations over the next several decades, ensuring that the phrase is still heavily analyzed to this day. Anyway, I now want to discuss a couple of other details about this case which are often repeated and seem to become public knowledge when the Black Country Bugle newspaper published a 30th anniversary article about this story in September of 1973. The article featured an interview with a retired police inspector named Dick Scarratt, who claimed that in July of 1941, the authorities received a call about a female scream being heard near Hagley Wood, and even though Scarratt personally answered the call and performed a search of the area, he found nothing. Of course, it's possible that this alleged scream meant nothing, but since Bella is believed to have been killed sometime in 1941, the scream could have been her. Following the publication of this article, two readers wrote into the paper to share some surprising new information, which got published in a new article 1 month later. One of these readers was Jeffrey Grove, who had been a non-commissioned officer in the Home Guard, an armed citizen militia which supported the British Army during World War II. Grove claimed that sometime in 1941, his colleagues found a pair of German silk parachutes in the Coleman Hill area of Halesowen. Grove believed these parachutes belonged to a pair of secret agents who arrived in the country, and that one of them may have been Bella. However, Grove also claimed that it was common knowledge that witches' Sabbaths were being held in Hagley Wood during this time period, so I might take his story with a grain of salt. But the other interesting story was provided by a man named Harry Basterfield, who had also been a soldier in the Home Guard back in 1941. Basterfield's patrol had received reports about parachutists being seen near the village of Clent, and while performing a search for them, they came across a parked car next to Hagley Wood. When Basterfield approached the vehicle, he saw a man dressed in a Royal Air Force sergeant's uniform in the front seat, who immediately held up an RAF identification card. There was a woman huddled in the passenger seat, whose entire body and most of her face were covered in a trench coat. But even though Basterfield never saw her make a movement, he decided not to question her, as he figured she was a local woman trying to avoid being caught in an embarrassing situation. This was the last time that Basterfield or his patrol saw the car, the RAF sergeant, or the woman, but he claimed that the car had been parked only a few hundred yards away from the Witch Elm, and after reading the Black Country Bugle article 3 decades later, Basterfield began to wonder if this sighting may have been significant. So could the female passenger in the car have been Bella, and the RAF sergeant her killer? Since Basterfield never saw the woman move, could she already have been dead by this point? We'll talk more about the theory involving Jack Mossop momentarily, but it's worth noting that he apparently liked to wear an RAF uniform around in public in order to impress people, even though he never actually served in the RAF, as he only spent about a year or so as a pilot officer in air service training in Scotland before he was discharged in around 1938, possibly following an accident. Also, if Jack Mossop was the RAF sergeant seen in the car, then this goes against the story he shared with his wife about having one or two additional people with him when he disposed of Bella's body. However, let's take a few moments to explore the plausibility of the theory that Bella was a foreign spy who entered England illegally, whether by parachuting or through other means. Of course, the theory presented by Donald McCormick in his book Murder by Witchcraft is that Bella was a secret agent named Clarabella Dronkers, who was sent by the Abwehr on a mission to parachute into the West Midlands sometime in 1941, but failed to make any further contact with her superiors. McCormick apparently heard from a source that Clara was a relative of Johannes Marius Dronkers, a German secret agent who was able to infiltrate England under the pretense of being a member of the Dutch resistance, but wound up being executed in 1942 after he was exposed as being a spy. Well, even though Johannes Marius Dronkers was a real person, there's never been any official confirmation that Clarabella Dronkers actually existed. I don't want to spend too much time delving into Donald McCormick's background, but let's just say he was a pretty controversial figure who published a number of books about such topics as spies and Jack the Ripper, but the problem is that these books were often filled with inaccuracies, and McCormick was known for making wild, unsubstantiated claims, which he said were provided to him by shadowy, anonymous sources. Indeed, even though McCormick maintained that he first learned about Clarabella Dronkers from a former Nazi living in Paraguay under an assumed name, he never actually explained how he managed to track this Nazi down to begin with. So yeah, even though I wouldn't completely discount the theory that Bella was a spy, I don't think I would rely on Donald McCormick's word to support it. However, one of the stories that Jack Mossop allegedly shared with his wife, Una Hainsworth, is that Bella worked as an emissary for a spy ring and may have been killed because she knew too much. But of course, since this is a case in which we have conflicting information from different sources, there are multiple versions out there of Jack's story, and considering that it was first shared over a decade after he died, I have no idea which version might be the correct one. The two main scenarios presented are that this mysterious Dutchman named Van Ralt and an unidentified trapeze artist killed Bella in the backseat of a car while Jack was driving, and they conspired to hide her body inside the witch elm. Or alternatively, Bella passed out while drinking with Jack and Van Ralt, and they decided to put her body in the tree as a practical joke, but she wound up dying. Needless to say, I have issues with both these stories, but you have to remember that Una was only sharing what her husband had told her, so even if Una was being truthful, there's a good chance Jack was not. I think it goes without saying that the scenario where Bella died accidentally is not very believable. I know it's common practice to play pranks on people if they get drunk and pass out, but I think there's a major difference between drawing penises on their forehead and driving out into the woods to place their unconscious body inside a hollow tree. That sounds like a pretty complicated prank, so if Jack was complicit in Bella's death, this could have been his way of confessing and clearing his conscience to his wife by making it sound like the whole thing was a tragic accident. At no point did Jack ever admit to killing Bella himself, as his other version of events is that Van Ralt and the trapeze artist committed the murder and frightened him into helping them conceal Bella's body. One detail which is often shared about this version of the story is that Jack was selling off information about local munitions factories to the spy ring. In fact, some sources say that Jack was employed by a munitions factory, but this isn't quite accurate, as he actually worked at an assembly shop manufacturing Bristol Hercules aero engines. I'm not sure if Jack would have had much access to intel that would be of interest to a spy ring, but Una did say that he started coming into large sums of money and never explained where it came from. I have no idea who this so-called trapeze artist could have been, but even though investigators were never able to figure out who Van Ralt was, it sounds like he did exist, as Una recalled him visiting their home sometime in 1940. Now, some people were apparently dismissive of Una's story because she waited over 10 years to come forward, but we have to look at the full context of the situation. According to Una, Jack shared his story about putting a woman in the witch elm sometime in 1941, and shortly thereafter, the couple separated, and Una moved to the town of Henley-in-Arms, which is located over 20 miles away from Hagley. By the time Bella's skeleton was discovered, Jack had already died inside the mental health facility, and since information did not travel as freely during the 1940s, Una maintained that she never heard about the Witch Elm mystery until she read Wilfred Byford Jones's articles about the case in 1953, which caused her to have flashbacks to her former husband's original story. And you also have to keep in mind that since Jack was confined to the mental health facility, and he openly told Una that he believed he was losing his mind, she had no reason to think his story might be legitimate. If Una was being completely honest and truthful about what Jack told her, then I think this lends credence to the possibility of him having some sort of knowledge or involvement in Bella's death. Remember, her skeleton was not found until April of 1943, 8 months after Jack died, yet he's sharing stories about placing a woman's body in a hollow witch elm and having visions of her leering at him from inside the tree. At that point, no one should have known that Bella's remains were there, so it would be one hell of a coincidence if Jack said all this stuff without having some sort of inside knowledge about what happened. The fact that Jack seemed to go on a complete downward spiral around the approximate time period Bella was believed to have been killed and soon died a premature death at a young age does suggest that he was being plagued by guilt over something. But if Jack or Van Ralt or any other individuals were complicit in Bella's death, are there any alternative explanations which do not involve aspiring? Well, this angle doesn't get talked about all that much, but I've always been intrigued by the account from the sex worker who told police that another sex worker named Bella, who was believed to be Dutch and known for working the Hagley area, went missing without explanation sometime in 1941. Of course, we don't have too many other details about this, but I think that the theory of Bella being a sex worker is a pretty believable one. In fact, if Bella really was Dutch and did not hail from England, then she may not have had any friends or family in the country, which is why it took so long for anybody to notice she was missing. Bella's disappearance could be a simple case of her being killed by someone who picked her up for sex work. If the perpetrator was a local resident who was familiar with the area, they may have decided that the best place to hide her body was the hollow cavity of the witch elm tree in Hagley Wood. And of course, if the killer never even met Bella before this, then they wouldn't have any real connection between them, making it difficult for the investigation to turn up any compelling leads. This is just a shot in the dark, but what if there really is some truth to the story that Bella met Jack and Van Ralt inside a local pub, but it was actually for the purposes of soliciting sex work? Something then went horribly wrong, which led to Bella being killed, so the responsible parties decided to cover up the crime by putting her body in the witch elm. I mean, this scenario does seem pretty plausible, but for all we know, the murder and the concealment could have been done by someone else besides Jack Mossop. But if Jack was involved, then his actions obviously tormented him and completely ruined his life, and he probably never envisioned that Bella's death would become such a huge local legend. So after all this time, is there any way to conclusively solve this case? Well, DNA testing has proven that no case is completely unsolvable, but obviously this is not an option unless Bella's remains can be recovered. And of course, it's pretty much a given that the person responsible for Bella's death is long dead by now. But I definitely believe that the memory of Bella, or whatever this woman's real name was, should be kept alive. Like I mentioned numerous times, this is one of those older mysteries which has been surrounded by so much misinformation and sensationalistic details that filtering out the actual truth about what happened is very difficult. But at the very least, I hope that this podcast episode has helped clear up some of the misconceptions about this story. I remain skeptical that Bella's death had anything to do with espionage or witchcraft, as the solution to this mystery may be a whole lot more simple. It sounds like the person who started the trend of leaving the cryptic graffiti may have been nothing more than a crank, but they did give birth to the phrase, "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" and somehow managed to ensure that this case will never be forgotten. So if by chance you do happen to have any information about this woman's identity, or have the answer to the nearly 80-year-old question, "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about an odd case from Unsolved Mysteries, the story of Dan Tondevold, a mysterious con artist who swindled a wealthy socialite out of her fortune before he supposedly killed himself in what may have been an attempt to fake his own death. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1971 murder of an unidentified Jane Doe known only as Little Miss Panasofsky. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. We would also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past few weeks, and they are John G., Joe E., and Liz B. Thank you all so much for your support. Anyway, I wanted to mention that this coming weekend, on Saturday, October the 22nd, we are going to be holding our next Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, in which we'll be screening classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and share comments with myself and your fellow listeners. And of course, since Halloween is just around the corner, this particular live watch is going to feature a number of supernatural-themed segments from Unsolved Mysteries. You can find the link to our screening room in this episode's show notes, and it is also pinned at the top of our social media pages. So once again, our next Unsolved Mysteries live watch takes place this coming weekend on Saturday, October the 22nd at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the eerie music you hear on every episode, and you might have noticed that we brought back the spookier version of his Trail Went Cold theme this month for our Halloween episodes. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week, and join us next Wednesday for this month's final Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold.